91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Though successful medical benchmarks have been reached, in the past six decades or so, the quote, cure for cancer has been elusive. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. In the next hour, we get an update on cancer research with the director of the University of Miami's Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center, Dr. Stephen Neimer. He's a professor of medicine, biochemistry, and molecular biology. We especially look into the Cancer Moonshot 2020 program, which is a declaration in the spirit of JFK and the space program. Moonshot is a coalition of pharmaceuticals, biotechs, oncologists, academics, and other major players. So stay with us. Topical Currents and the Cancer Moonshot. Next, after the news. And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. Is it possible to dream of a next-generation cancer cure within but 4 years? Today we'll discuss just where we are on cancer research and where perhaps we stand on winning the battle with such a dogged disease.
Joining us now is the director of the University of Miami Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center, Dr. Stephen Neimer. He's a professor of medicine, biochemistry, and molecular biology, and he's here to tell us about next-generation vaccine-based cancer care with the Cancer Moonshot 2020 program.
Moonshot is a very determined coalition of the most brilliant, efficient, and promising scientists and major payers pledged to develop immunotherapies by the year 2020.
Dr. Stephen Neimer, welcome.
Thank you very much, Bonnie.
We'll be all ears now. You were the only representative from Florida, I understand, who participated in this initial meeting with the Vice President Biden to kick off Cancer Moonshot 2020. So if you'll just tell us what it is, who it was conceived by, and what is its mission?
Okay, so the Moonshot is an initiative that Joe Biden, Vice President Joe Biden, has led, in part a reaction to what he saw when his own son was dealing with the diagnosis of a brain tumor. And the time is right now to bring together a coalition of people who've had trouble collaborating properly and effectively to fight this deadly battle against this deadly disease called cancer. And so the Moonshot has, by its very name, a notion of a overarching goal. And the goal is to really to accelerate and double the progress that we're going to make against cancer over the next 5 years, with help from the government, with involvement from pharma, involvement from insurers, the academic centers, researchers, and some philanthropists as well.
Where does the next generation aspect of this fit in?
So there are immunotherapies that are available now that are really changing the lives of patients with cancer. For example, President Jimmy Carter has a melanoma, and his melanoma was treated with immunotherapy. It's gone, and he's now, you know, off treatment right now. Melanoma is a disease that, you know, when I was a young trainee, I used to see patient after patient who had no hope. And young people would die one after another from a melanoma that had spread throughout their body. In fact, I went to see my dermatologist after I had taken care of one young man who died from melanoma to have some rather harmless-looking moles removed because I was concerned that there was no hope for anybody with melanoma. Now, 30 or 50% of the people who are treated with immunotherapy for melanoma are alive 3 and 5 years later, which is really unheard of. And so for some diseases like melanoma, one drug may be effective, although in melanoma we now know that two immunotherapies when combined give much better results. But the next generation is to not give one drug at a time and to learn how to combine drugs.
So you spoke, though, as though there were a hurdle in previous efforts to treat cancer. What were those hurdles, and how will they change?
Well, there have been so many hurdles. You know, one of the things that's...
I mean, institutional hurdles.
There's government hurdles, institutional hurdles. You know, the internet has changed the information flow in cancer. So I'm always asked by patients and families, do you talk with your colleagues about what's going on in cancer research? And the answer is yes. We don't even have to wait for the national meetings to hear what everyone's doing. It's on the internet, and we communicate in different ways. But a lot of these therapies, which come from pharma, are under patent protection. Pharma is sometimes worried about the side effects if you combine two experimental therapies. And so the progress of combining treatments has been very slow, in part because everyone has their idea of how they should be combined. And so different institutions around the United States all test their favorite version of a combination. But also there have been legal impediments and other corporate reasons why we can't combine things in the way that we would like to make the fastest progress.
And the patients say, I need help now. Don't quibble.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. When you think of what the patients need, there are treatments where insurance companies have deemed them to be experimental and they won't pay for these treatments. Right. Immunotherapy is very expensive. And so there are patients who have been denied the ability to get some of these therapies because of the expense.
And how is that going to change? Because you often hear of people not being able to afford the treatment for cancer. How is that going to change?
So in the Moonshot 2020 that you refer to, the notion is that the pharmaceutical companies will make these drugs available for people on trials free. And so the goal was to treat 20,000 patients, I believe, by 2020. And so once these therapies are shown to be effective in certain combinations, then they can be used for patients. And paying for these drugs is always a big problem.
Right. So the immunotherapy, which I want to get more into to explain exactly what that is, but you say there are some being used. This is going to be used in combination with chemotherapy and radiation, or more by itself?
So for many of the immunotherapies, they work 20 or 30% of the time, and we don't really know why they work in some patients and they don't work in others. And so when you think about it, there's a battle going on in the patient's body. And the battle is a battle between the immune system and the cancer. And so we've learned a lot about how to remove the camouflage from cancer cells so that the immune system can target them better. That's what's called checkpoint blockade.
Okay.
There's the first new drug for melanoma. That's how that worked. And so one is to make the cancer cell more susceptible to immune system, and then the other is to beef up the immune side of things. There's something called, we refer to them as CAR T cells. CAR stands for chimeric antigen receptor, and basically you take the immune cells out of the patient's body, and in the laboratory you supercharge them so they can, when they're put back into the body, they hone almost like a smart bomb against the cancer.
Why is our immune system so... Why has cancer been able to avoid our natural immune system? Why is it so difficult, unlike other diseases, where our own immune system kicks in?
Right. So, first of all, the immune system is really designed for taking care of infections. So anything that's foreign, your immune system can recognize immediately as foreign and attack. But cancer comes from within. And, you know, most cancers occur in people that are in their 50s, 60s, 70s. And so the cancer has lots of time, decades, in which it can emerge by camouflaging itself from the immune system. Any cancer cells that are recognizable are killed. And so that's why we don't get cancer all the time. But as the cells in your body grow, every so often a mistake is made in the DNA. And if that mistake allows that cell to grow, we're very dependent on the immune system from getting rid of those cells. And so as we age, our immune system is less agile. And so when the cells in your body are on their way to becoming cancer, your immune system loses the ability to keep track.
Is there an ability of cancer cells to mutate and therefore adapt to treatments?
So one of the absolutely, one of the things we've learned from the whole genome sequencing, where we take hundreds of patients with a specific type of cancer, whether it be lung cancer or leukemia, and we sequence the entire DNA of the cancer cell.
What does that mean, you sequence the DNA?
So the genes in your body are made up of DNA, and the genes determine everything that happens in your body.
Mm-hmm.
The DNA is like an alphabet. There's A, C, G, and T. And there's so many different combinations that you can put those together that you can explain everything in the human body based on the DNA. And so when a cancer gets a mutation, either it loses one of the letters of the alphabet or the letter changes from an A to a G or an A to a T. And then that changes, that can change the entire behavior of the cancer cell. Also, bits of the DNA can move from their normal location, what we call a translocation, and hook up with the wrong piece of DNA on another chromosome in the body. Some of these are harmless, and the cell gets no advantage, but some of these cause cancer.
It seems so daunting. If the cancer cells themselves can evolve, then how do you keep up with, I mean, if you're trying to treat it and it's ever changing, how do you do that?
So that's what we call precision medicine. So precision medicine is to understand everyone's cancer as best we can, and also to understand how it evolves over time. And that's really, the treatments now are geared towards targeting the cancer cell and not targeting the normal cells in your body. What's very attractive about immunotherapy is that immunotherapy is based on recognizing the cancer cell from the outside. So whatever goes on the inside in the DNA of the cell, the immunotherapy doesn't matter that much, because the immune system is looking at the outside of the cancer cell and it sees something it can attack.
Mm. We're speaking with Dr. Steven Nimer. He's the director of the Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center and a professor of medicine, biochemistry, and molecular biology. He's an expert in treating leukemia and lymphoma. We will be talking more about that, and we're focusing on the Cancer Moonshot 2020 program on today's Topical Currents. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. And we resume our conversation with Dr. Steven Nimer. He's the director of the University of Miami Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center, part of the Miller School of Medicine, of course. And we're talking about Cancer Moonshot 2020 also. Doctor, tell us more about the QUILT acronym that's being used in 2020.
So the QUILT trial is actually a collection of about 60 different trials that are going to combine different forms of immunotherapy. It resembles a quilt in that it has different components. And there will be a number of academic centers and community hospitals that will be testing new combinations of immunotherapy. And that the goal is, again, to put 20,000 patients on clinical trials by the year 2020.
How are the patients, these 20,000 patients, being chosen? Does one try to sign up for this? Do you choose them? Are you targeting certain cancers, certain tumors? How is this happening?
So the first step in the QUILT trial is to have the DNA, what we call the genomics of the cancer, evaluated, and also the proteomics. It turns out that you can have a mutation in the DNA, and I apologize for this being complicated.
Well, we're taking it step by step.
We're barely keeping up. We're all right.
Okay. But it is the proteins in the cell that carry out the function. And so you can have a mutation in the DNA, but if that mutation is not also found in a protein, you may think you have a target, but you may not have a target. And so what the QUILT trial will do is look at the DNA and look at the protein in the cancer cell and try to identify a target that could be recognized by the immune system. And it won't be just one trial. It'll be somewhere on the order of 60 trials. And so depending on exactly what are the targets in a given person's cancer, they will become eligible for a vaccine and an immunotherapy, or a chemotherapy drug and immunotherapy, or even radiation of the tumor with immunotherapy. And the goal is to have academic centers like Sylvester and also some community partners to participate so we can get to the 20,000 people.
Does immunotherapy have as negative side effects as radiation and chemotherapy?
Immunotherapy has its own side effects. And so the immune system, when it's overactive, can actually start to target the normal parts of your body. One example for many of this is the thyroid. So thyroid diseases tend to be what we call autoimmune. Mm-hmm. People know that arthritis can be autoimmune, mm-hmm. so can thyroid disease. And so when you give some of these immunotherapies, you can trigger autoimmunity. And so thyroid disease, colitis involving the gut, skin rash, some of which can be severe. And as we rev up the immune system to target the cancer, the immune system can go haywire. And so there are some neurologic side effects, and some people get into breathing difficulties. And so there, some of these immunotherapies, which are very powerful, also have side effects. But the more we give them, the more we are used to dealing with the side effects, and they tend to be limited in duration.
Is it similar to chemotherapy effects?
Well, you know, what's interesting, because I have these conversations with patients all the time.
Sure.
Patients getting chemotherapy oftentimes have almost no side effects from the chemotherapy that they feel. You know, we monitor the blood counts and we monitor the chemistries, but people generally, for one thing, they don't throw up. And many of our therapies now don't cause people to lose hair. And so when you see somebody without hair, you can know that they're on chemotherapy. But so many of the chemotherapies don't cause hair loss that it's not a sign. And so I tell some of my patients they have to watch what they're eating, because you can gain weight while you're getting chemotherapy.
Oh, right.
And that's because the drugs to prevent nausea and vomiting are so powerful now that people continue to eat.
If you're going to try and get 20,000 patients on these clinical trials, do clinical trials always involve placebos as well? Does that mean some people are not going to be getting it and they won't know it?
So for each approach to therapy, there's usually three phases. The first, what we call phase one, you have a treatment and you're not quite sure how to give it. You may not know the dose. You may not know how often a patient will tolerate the treatment. And so the first patients are getting a dose that's far below what you think would cause side effects, and then you slowly escalate. Once you've got a dose and a schedule, as we say, you know, how often to give the drug, then you go into phase two. And in phase two, generally, all the patients get the treatment. And in phase two, you see how many people respond when they're given a dose that's the correct dose. And then the last phase is called phase three. That often will have a placebo control, meaning half the patients or a third of the patients get nothing, or they may get drug A alone, and the other half of the patients get drug A plus immunotherapy. And that's to prove beyond a doubt that the treatment is better than whatever exists at the moment.
You know what I'm thinking? You gave the example of President Carter and the melanoma. Can you explain exactly what happened with the immunotherapy to his melanoma that made it go away?
Sure. I mean, as best as anybody can.
Yeah.
But the, so melanoma can evade the immune system by putting a protein on its surface, or even sometimes putting proteins into the bloodstream that confuse the immune system. And so what President Carter got, and I'm not his doctor.
Right.
He hasn't authorized me to say anything.
So we can understand.
Yes. So what happens is that you unleash the immune system. I believe he got a drug called ipilimumab, which is a way of supercharging the T cells in your body so that the T cell can fight the melanoma. And the T cells, as we learned, can go everywhere, including into the brain. And so that a battle ensues. And usually
T cells are blood cells?
Your immune system is made up of B cells and T cells.
Okay.
The T cells come from the thymus, which is why they're called T cells, and the B cells come from the bone marrow. And those are two important components. There are so many different cells. There's natural killer cells and natural killer T cells. But in general...
So it is Star Wars.
It is Star Wars. And so some of these cells kill when they recognize something on the cell. Natural killer cells kill when they don't find something on the cell. So every cell in your body has a little identity. And when the natural killer cells go through your bloodstream, as long as every cell on your body has this little ID tag, it knows things are good. If a cell in your body gets a virus infected, one of the first things the virus does is it removes the tag. And so as soon as it removes the tag, the natural killer cell says, hey, there's a cell in my body that doesn't have the tag, I'm going to kill it. The same thing can happen with cancers. The cancer cell gets in, its initial attempt to evade the immune system involves removing the ID tag from the outside of the cancer cell, and then the natural killer cells come in and start killing. So then, in the Star Wars battle, the cancer cell finds another way to disable the natural killer cells. And so what all these treatments are is a way to give the immune system a leg up. So in this battle, the cancer cell is always trying to weaken the immune system, and these drugs strengthen. And then it's like a tug of war on a rope. And the cancer cell pulls for a while, the immune cell pulls, and then these immunotherapies are these big muscle men that go and help the immune system so that you can kill the cancer.
And so that's how you can...
So for President Carter, you know, melanoma was one of the first cancers that we understood could have an immune component. Steve Rosenberg at the National Cancer Institute did some trials of interleukin-2. They gave these patients extremely toxic doses of interleukin-2. The patients were all in the ICU. Many of the patients died from the treatments, but around 10% of the people were cured of an incurable cancer. And that was one of the first bits of evidence to tell us that melanoma could be a cancer where we could use this immunotherapy.
And most people would take that chance, don't you think?
You know, I think so. People should take, you know, we need people, it's not what we need. Most people want to live. It's one of the most powerful urges
in life.
They'll
take a long shot. It's something that might work, yeah.
Right. Yes.
I see that only Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center and Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa are participating in the state of Florida in this Moonshot 2020. How was that determined? Who would get, which academic or which cancer centers would be involved?
So I think they're still recruiting.
I see.
They're actively recruiting. And I think that, you know, Florida has some very unique features. So as somebody who moved from New York, you know, we're now the third largest state in the United States. We have the second most cases of cancer, second only to California. And if you do it on a per patient, per capita basis, we have a higher incidence of cancer than any big state in the United States. And in part, it reflects the elderly populations that we have in Florida. And so I think the cancer centers, the academic cancer centers in Florida, want to participate in these things and need to participate in these efforts so that we can help the people who live in our community.
We're speaking about Cancer Moonshot 2020 with Dr. Stephen Nimer. He's the director of the Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center. Formerly, Dr. Nimer was head of the Division of Hematological Oncology at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. A short break. We'll be right back.
And we continue with today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and University of Miami Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center's director, Dr. Stephen Nimer. We're also talking about the Moonshot 2020 program. Doctor, back to the Moonshot. There's 4 years until 2020, which is the target date. What would you be happy to see solved in the next 4 years to really make meaningful strides?
What would make me happiest is if we had a dozen new cures for cancer. But it's not likely
to
happen.
Realistically.
Yes. I think getting people together, getting the public educated about the problem, getting stakeholders that have not worked together before to all contribute. You know, the United States is an amazing country, and we have such incredible physicians and cancer researchers and such dedicated people. And so if this moonshot can really allow us to work together and fulfill the potential, our scientific knowledge has never been greater, and there's so many patients who need better therapies for their cancer, that if we could make more rapid progress over the next 4 years and come up with a couple important cures, that would be an amazing thing.
Are we talking about cures, or are we talking about the cancer going into remission?
So for a cancer to be cured, it must go into remission.
And then it's cured?
And then if it doesn't come back, it's cured. So cancer can't be cured unless it goes into remission. And for many cancers, if it stays away for 5 years, then we know that it's in remission. We were talking earlier about melanoma. And we look even at the 3-year survival rates. So it looks like if you've survived melanoma for 3 years after immunotherapy, you may be cured. And so that's the goal, is to have people get back to their normal lives and not have to deal with cancer again.
Is Moonshot, Cancer Moonshot 2020 also dealing with quality of life issues as well as just the cancer, treatment of the cancer?
You know, we are always concerned about quality of life issues, but for many of these diseases, the prognosis is dreadful. And so we really need to come up with ways to keep people alive.
Okay.
Of course, the side effects are also important, but many of the newer targeted therapies and immunotherapies are safer or less side effects than the old treatments. And so I think that we're going to be keeping tabs on quality of life, because that's obviously the goal, is to get people back to a normal life. But right now we're also focusing on some of the toughest cancers, pancreas cancer, certain types of brain tumors. These are things that scare people when they're given a diagnosis, and because the prognosis is bad.
Part of the Moonshot talks about having that big science needs to use unbiased testing. Does that assume there has been biased testing in the past? And how can it be ended?
So one way is for everyone to agree together to test certain concepts, as opposed to only testing your own ideas. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't necessarily refer to that as a bias, but we're all doing research. We all think we have great ideas, but it's slow to test everyone's idea. And so by us working together, we can test this idea, that idea. There's a component about sharing data in a novel way. And I think that if we can share big data, as it's called, rapidly, we're going to learn so much more than if the data sits in silos at each institution.
So it can be patented.
Many people are really suspicious of big pharma.
Yeah.
What is their role in this, and how will they assuage those feelings of people that they're really interested in the bottom line and designer drugs and advertising?
Right. Well, the fact is that it's extraordinarily expensive to develop a new drug. Some people say it's $1 billion. And so academic institutions, the universities and the government, is not able to spend that kind of money to develop a new drug. And so pharma is a critical collaborator and component of this, that we all have conflict of interest regulations at our institutions to make sure that we're unbiased in the way that we evaluate these drugs. Oftentimes we have blinded trials where the doctors and the nurses, no one, even the patients, they don't know if they're getting the drug or they're not getting a drug. And only when the trial is over is the data unblinded, and then we find out if the drug worked or didn't work. And so I think that rather than finding villains among the insurance industries or the government or pharma, is that we need to understand that this problem is an incredibly difficult one for us to solve. And the only way to do it is to put aside our biases and to work together.
You mentioned just now the trials, and I had asked you about clinical trials and asked if some patients would receive placebos. You were just talking about blind trials, and you wanted to add something to that. You said there were three stages, and sometimes in the third stage.
Right.
But you wanted to add something.
Sure. So there are cancers where 5% of the patients are alive in 2 years. So if you have a drug where suddenly 40% of the patients are alive at approaching 2 years, do you really need then to do another trial where it's placebo? Mm-hmm. And so the FDA has been very good, especially recently in the last year or two, approving lots of drugs because they look so effective compared to what we know historically over the past decades. Now, they always want a confirmatory trial after they've approved this, but this is what people want. We want effective drugs, we want safe drugs, and we don't want things slowed down.
How about keeping huge databases worldwide so that if someone comes up with something in Ceylon, we know about it in Hallandale, Florida?
Yeah, well, I think that we need to be able to know what's going on. The internet has been incredibly helpful at distributing science worldwide. So, for instance, China, which has a very active medical research community, they publish their abstracts and things the same way everyone else does, and so we can know what's going on around the world. But the other problem with big data is the safety. So, you know, there
are patient privacy.
Patient privacy, genetic data. Mm-hmm. What is the, if you have a familial predisposition to something, do you want your employer to get access to that? Do you want the insurance company to know that you are at risk for this disease or that? And so there's got to be a lot of safeguards in place. People are more willing to accept things in cancer because give up a little privacy if they're going to get some drugs quicker. But some diseases, which are really lifelong diseases, diabetes or other things, you know, privacy issues are very important for us to deal with.
So would you explain what your role is specifically and the role of the Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Care Center in Moonshot 2020, Cancer Moonshot 2020? How does that work exactly?
Okay. So we're cheerleaders and we're participants. I think what we want to do is to make sure that this is a successful initiative. And so we have currently a number of immunotherapy trials. There is a drug that's FDA approved to treat lymphoma called brentuximab, and that drug was really invented by one of the Sylvester researchers. It made its way through the FDA. It's now curing people with lymphoma. These CAR T cells that we talked about, mm-hmm. We're participating in three different trials of CAR T cells in children and in adults with leukemia and with lymphoma. And so we're actively developing vaccines, and so we look at the moonshot as an opportunity for us to get some of our ideas and our research out across the nation to be tested not just by ourselves, but by all the different centers that are going to participate. Similarly, patients need access to these drugs, and it is a unique idea to have people getting two or three different types of therapy at the same time. And so we want to be able to offer that. You know, we're in Miami-Dade. You know, we're currently in your studio in Miami-Dade. But about 50% of our patients come from Palm Beach and Broward County. And we have 6 satellite locations. And so it's not just about patients coming here to get these intensive therapies, but also to make them available in the community. And Vice President Biden is aware of the fact that so many patients with cancer don't come to the university-based cancer centers.
Exactly.
And so part of the moonshot is also to make things accessible to them. But these drugs have a steep learning curve in terms of knowing how to give them. And so you don't want these dangerous drugs being given by physicians who aren't familiar with them.
But how would, let's say, people who are with very little means, who can't afford to go to, you know, University Cancer Center, and even inner city people, how are they going to find their way to treatment?
So I would say that, you know, the Sylvester doctors also take care of patients at Jackson Memorial Hospital. I'd also say that in terms of the expense, there's some data to say that if your cancer is taken care of at a university hospital by doctors and staff who really know what they're doing, it can actually be more efficient and less expensive than if you're cared for. In terms of some people have too many CAT scans or too many MRIs or things. Mm-hmm. And so, but the notion is that we'll need to monitor patients with cancer that are getting these new treatments to make sure that we can see if they're effective and know what the side effects are. And we're very agnostic. I mean, one of the reasons why I came from Sloan Kettering down to the University of Miami and to Sylvester is that we take care of patients who come in the door, regardless of yeah. ability to pay.
From a ballpark standpoint, in your opinion, what are the top research centers in the United States for cancer?
Well, you know, I hate to go by the U.S. News and World Report, but I will say that there's an alliance of dedicated cancer centers. That are 11 cancer centers around the United States. They're so designated because they're solely focused on cancer. Moffitt is one, Sylvester is one, MD Anderson in Houston is one, Sloan Kettering is one, Dana-Farber, the Fred Hutch, Ohio State. Those 11 have actually recently, there's a publication showing that if you are treated for cancer at one of those 11 institutions, your chances of being alive 5 years later is better than at any other type of cancer center in the United States.
And you said you were looking for the NCI designation at Sylvester. And what does that mean exactly? And designation being designated by the National Cancer Institute?
So at the moment, there are 42 NCI designated comprehensive cancer centers in the United States. And it's a symbol that you have achieved a level of research. It doesn't have to do with the way you take care of patients,
right.
But you have research in the laboratory, you have population science, you have prevention and cancer control that's at the highest level and that you're contributing on a national stage. Given the almost 21 million people that are in Florida, we really ought to have 3 NCI-designated centers, and we and the University of Florida are pursuing NCI designation.
Okay. We're speaking with Dr. Stephen Nimer, the director of the Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center and an expert in treating leukemia and lymphoma. We're also talking about Cancer Moonshot 2020. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Dr. Stephen Nimer. We're talking about Moonshot 2020, the Moonshot 2020 program, a determined coalition, the most brilliant, efficient, and promising scientists, and also the major payers pledged to develop immunotherapies by the year 2020. Doctor, tell us a hopeful story about this research.
So, you know, about a year after I moved to Miami, I got invited by my college roommate to attend his grandmother's 100th birthday party up in Boca Raton. So I was there, and he knew, and I knew, and his grandma's children knew that I had actually treated her for lymphoma when she was 90. As her birthday party was coming to a close, She told everybody that she didn't want to be late for the bus that was going to bring her back to Boca Raton. And so here's a woman now, she's 103 right now, and she is totally functional. The thought that maybe she wouldn't have been treated for her lymphoma when she was 90 would have deprived her of a 13 years of life, of great quality life. And I think one of the messages when we think about precision medicine is also to understand what we can do for patients and to make sure we offer each and every patient a chance at a cure.
I guess the flip side of that is when you often hear that someone who is that age and is going to get all these terrible side effects and surgery or whatever from a certain cancer treatment, and you know how within a family there's a tug of war because you know you don't want to lose them. On the other hand, you don't want to make their life miserable. But you're saying in this case it was not that way.
You know, we try not to think about chronological age anymore, and we try to think about physiological age. So if we look back at our own parents and grandparents, you know, my grandfather, when he was 60, was ancient.
Right.
He had all kinds of problems. He could barely walk around. And I think now, to this woman who's 103, and we all know 80 and 90-year-olds that are completely functional, I think one is to give people the chance to decide what they want. You know, it's been something I've said my entire career, is that the purpose of the doctor is not to convince the patient what to do, but is to understand what the patient would like to have done, and then to make it happen.
Well, that's...
We have a caller here who wants to know more about immunotherapy and how it plays in hormone-driven cancers.
So the hormone-driven cancers tend to be things like prostate cancer in men, breast cancer, and ovarian cancer in women. And the immunotherapies so far have been effective, not any more effective in hormone-responsive cancers than in not. And I think that we're still at the tip of the iceberg a little bit in breast cancer for evaluating immunotherapies. They seem to be working. I think we still need to work out the combinations.
We were talking also during the break. You had mentioned that Florida per capita has the highest cancer population in the United States. What about pediatric care? What about children?
So, you know, the best news is that cancer is still a rare entity in children. Most children live normal, healthy lives. The number of cancer cases are still small. But anytime you see a child with cancer, you know, it pulls at our heartstrings, and the notion that kids may not be able to live a normal life. You know, there's a patient I remember, I won't say her last name, but her first name was Crystal, and I took care of her a while ago. She had a very serious blood disease, and she died at age 18. And what I remember more than anything else about her was that she had never been on a date. And the fact is that if Crystal walked in to see the doctor in 2016 with exactly the same blood disease as she had, she would have about a 60% chance of being cured. She could then go on and have her own family. And so that's what motivates us so much, is the notion that the life of a child could be taken away before it's reached its potential.
So you really think 2020 is doable?
There is a focus in the moonshot on pediatric cancers. Because of their rarity, it's harder to make progress because we do need patient numbers in order to see the progress. And I think that this is one of the most important steps, these moonshot initiatives, to getting us to where we need to be and to focus attention on this as a problem.
You know, in speaking with you, you've referred to a lot of patients that you've lost in the course of your years as a physician treating cancer. That I'm just wondering about the difficulty of that for you.
So, you know, I've always said that if I gave people cancer, that would be a terrible job. You know, the time I spend with my patients is often the most meaningful time of their lives. Everybody is together in a struggle to overcome cancer. I've picked leukemia and lymphoma and bone marrow transplants as a specialty because there are lots of cures. A few months ago at Sylvester, we celebrated our 500th transplant, our stem cell transplant, since we moved the transplant unit to Sylvester in 2011 from Jackson. And so there were dozens and dozens of patients who are alive who never would have been alive. And so I'd like to say a very optimistic message for patients.
Okay.
And so, we hope that the moonshot and many other things allow us to continue to keep people alive.
I just want to say here, the website is cancermoonshot2020.org. Is there any other contact information that you want to give?
Well, I'd say the sylvester.org, www.sylvester.org for our own cancer center. We're here as a resource to our community, and anything we can do to help patients, that's why we're here.
Tell us a little more about yourself, Doctor, briefly.
Well, I became interested in becoming a physician in college.
Where are you from?
I'm from Chicago. I went to MIT for my undergraduate. And then I was very fortunate at the University of Chicago Medical School to meet a woman who was a teacher named Janet Rowley. And Janet Rowley, at her time, was probably the most accomplished female cancer researcher. And so she was ultimately awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom and the Presidential Medal of Science, and she was a leukemia researcher. And from meeting her and a few other key people in my life, I became very interested in the battle and helping to understand and cure leukemia.
Must be very rewarding.
Every day is a special challenge.
Well, we want to thank you. Dr. Stephen Neimer is the director of the Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center. He's a professor of medicine, biochemistry, and molecular biology, and an expert in treating leukemia and lymphoma and bone marrow transplants. Formerly, Dr. Neimer was head of the Division of Hematologic Oncology at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City, where he was the Alfred P. Sloan Professor. And he was the only representative from Florida to participate in the inception meeting of Cancer Moonshot 2020, which was just in December. And we thank you, Dr. Stephen Neimer.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure.
And thanks for listening to today's program. Apologies to those listeners who called that we couldn't get to. Thanks for being with us. Today's hour was produced by Polly Landis with technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Richard Ives is lead producer. And as always, we have free audio downloads linked at our website. That's WLRN.org. More information, links, and pics at the Topical Currents Facebook page. And tomorrow we profile the multifaceted mayor of Coral Gables. He's a year into his third term. Mayor Jim Kaysen has 45 years in international and public service, a former ambassador to Peru, also U.S. Special Interest Section Chief in Havana. There's a job for you. And once an advisor to NATO, also a Fulbright scholar. That's at 1 o'clock. Our theme music created by Michael Levine. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.